Hi, everybody. This is Kevin Trimble.
And this is Amber Bradley.
Thanks for tuning in to today's TalkLP.com podcast. Today, we're going to focus on an uncomfortable topic very near and dear to most LP professionals.
False confessions.
Ouch. It hurts to hear those two words.
Well, unfortunately, this topic is emerging and gaining national recognition throughout the media, retail, and law enforcement agencies across the U.S.
Well, with all that being said, today we have a fantastic and a timely guest for this topic.
Kevin and I are very excited to introduce Dave Thompson, CFI. He is the Vice President of Operations for Wicklander Zalowski & Associates. Welcome, Dave Thompson.
Welcome, Dave.
Hey, thanks, Amber. Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be here.
Well, so as you know, this topic is near and dear to my heart, too, because I'm a bleeding heart for folks. Anyway, as you know, but this false confession thing really hit the mainstream, it seems, with the whole making a murderer, right? But Wicklander Zalowski, you guys have been on the forefront of interviewing and interrogation methods and practices for a long time. But you've recently made some changes to your method and how you guys go about teaching and ensuring that there aren't false confessions. So why don't we start with you just setting the stage of what recent changes WZ has made before we get into all the sensational false confessions in the media?
Sure. I mean, I think it's interesting if you look at WZ over the last 35 years, they've always been evolving and changing and reflecting, you know, what's going on in the academic world and in the legal world. But if you really look in the last, you know, 2 years or so, and I think, you know, Making a Murderer was a good spur to that as that came out late 2015. But in the last couple of years, WZ has really focused its training, not just on, you know, what to do in order to allow our participants to get to the truth, but also what not to do, and spending a lot of time in our seminars and in articles that we put out on what are some of the things that, you know, academics are pointing to and some of the causes of false confession. So that goes as far down to as updating and changing some of the actual WZ method itself, but also just in the instruction of the material. So it's been a great year of embracing some of that change, and we'll continue to see that going forward.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is something that has been part of my wheelhouse for what going on 25 to 30 years. And let's just put it out there. Most loss prevention folks, asset protection, the interrogation, the interview, the conversation, that's the adrenaline, right? That's kind of that's kind of what most people are drawn to this industry because of the challenge and because of the ability to crack the case, if you will. But at the same time, with all this change occurring, there's a lot of folks out there, including myself, that may have to kind of revisit, may have to actually soul search a little bit and realize that the practice in which they were utilizing or the approach in which they were taking, it's no longer ideal. It's just too much of a liability.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is the WZ method in itself has always been non-confrontational, and the core concepts of that method haven't changed. But simple things that, you know, when you start to look at cases that have come out recently, simple phrases or words that are chosen, you know, words have a significant impact on the person you're talking to. So I don't think it has to be as big as, you know, reinventing the wheel, but being aware of what we're saying. And I think it's also important, you know, Kevin, as you mentioned, a lot of practitioners realize that it's difficult to get somebody who did something wrong to tell you the truth. I mean, rarely are they going to come into a room and willingly provide that. So it's a difficult task that puts a lot of pressure on an investigator to try to get the truth out of somebody. And it's just making sure we balance that pressure and the pressure from the company and the organization to solve a case with making sure that the ends don't necessarily justify the means when it comes down to interrogations.
It's a great point. And I will tell you that I think that, you know, going back many moons ago, I think that there was that environment where the pressure was put on the loss prevention person, that he or she is responsible for closing X amount of cases. And we all know that's a very unhealthy environment. And I think that has changed as well, which hopefully is going to help the cause to get us all better at approaching these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it comes down to internal pressure as well. I mean, in my years of doing interviews in the field, you want to close a case, and this applies to, you know, loss prevention and detectives in the public sectors. You want to close a case to prevent future incidents. You want to solve a case to help the victim, whether it's a company or, you know, a family. And you also want to solve it for yourself. I mean, that's what we take pride on. But what happens oftentimes is investigators, all that pressure results in sometimes aggravation or almost desperation to solve the case, and results in confirmation bias, where we start to determine maybe who's guilty without taking all possible avenues and acceptable outcomes into our consideration. So having that open mind and realizing that sometimes the truth is not what it may seem is an important step forward.
So one of the things too, you talk about pressure, right? And several years ago, when I really first started out in this industry, I wrote an article for LP Magazine called "Are We the Liars?" Right? Which is really talking about the loss prevention professional in the interrogation room lying to get the confession. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people go, no way when an innocent person confessed to something they didn't do. So in your study and research of false confessions, give us a little background. I think that might be one of the biggest things, and maybe one of the biggest myths or stereotypes or whatever it's called, that people say there's just no way that an innocent person would even confess to stealing a sub sandwich when they didn't do it. You want to talk about that a little bit? Because I think if we could break down that bias with maybe some education, even in this forum, it would help tackle that subject.
Yeah, I think that's a common question or comment that we might get. I mean, in our public sector classes, we're now dedicating a portion of our seminar just to educate on causes of false confessions. And that question comes up, and I'll tell you, I mean, the research pretty much stands for itself, is we know it happens. About 30% of all these wrongful convictions where people have been exonerated with, you know, DNA evidence, about 30% had false confessions associated with them. So you've got several people not just admitting to $30 of money out of a register, but admitting to a homicide or a rape or a much more serious crime that they didn't commit. And it's hard to put yourself in that position, but I would say what makes it a little bit easier to try to think about is, as interviewers, especially those that have used the WZ method, we always talk about rationalizations and how oftentimes people do things they wouldn't normally do because of pressures that are put on them. So they might have stolen money because they owe some bills for their house or rent or whatever it might be. And we accept the fact that a really good person made a bad choice because of outside pressure. What we have to also accept is sometimes an innocent person, because of the pressures put on during that interview, whatever other pressures are on them, may actually admit to something they didn't do to also escape that pressure, whether it's they're in the room for an extended period of time and they want their freedom, whether they don't feel like somebody believes them, the only way to get out is tell them what they want to hear. Or maybe it comes down to they actually believe that they did it, right? The investigator tells them over and over again, there's no doubt what happened. And sometimes we actually have memory distrust and think, well, maybe I didn't put that $20 back in the register. Maybe I did put it in my pocket and I don't realize it. So there's so many different causes, many of which are caused by the interviewer almost unintentionally, that it definitely happens more than we would like and more than the average person may think.
You know, I'm going to jump in on that because I read an article that you had published, and it was pertaining to all different, I think it was called "I Did It, Why Innocent People Confess." And right. One thing that you had built into that article was the removal of the intent, and really, was it accident versus intentional? And again, I think back to my history of interviewing, and obviously, you know, we want to be able to give people the out, we want to be able to give people the door to open. But there's a fine line there. There's a fine line, because if you continue to call it a mistake and you continue to say that this isn't on you, this is just, you know, it's an accident, blah, 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 we're giving people the opportunity to kind of escape the situation. But at the end of the day, they're going to be held accountable for something they may or may not have done.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, Kevin. And when you talked about, you know, kind of some of the changes and those folks out there that are listening that have been interviewing for a long time, one of the things that we've really worked on educating our folks with is the difference between rationalizing and justifying, and the difference between minimizing what somebody did right in their own mind versus actually minimizing the consequences. And, you know, if you rationalize something in your mind that, you know, I only took money because my car broke down and I needed the money to pay for my car, if that's true and that was my motive, I still made the decision to steal money from the company and I still have moral responsibility for that. If, however, the investigator starts to say things like, well, maybe it's just an accident. Maybe you didn't mean to take the money. You forgot it. You had it with you. And they really remove in that person's mind any consequences associated with that. That doesn't necessarily cause the false confession, but it increases the risk because now if I feel like I can just tell you whatever you want to hear and I'm not going to get in trouble for it, why not if I get to leave the room? And in the public sector, oftentimes what you see is somebody confesses, and you saw this in Brendan Dassey's case, they'll confess to something that they potentially did not do and immediately think that they are free. And in Brendan's case, as soon as he admits to a violent rape and homicide, he asks if he can go back to school. So you can tell in the subject's mind, there's no consequences associated with their actions.
Yeah, I've seen it firsthand. And at the end of the day, I think that everything that we're talking about, everything that you've published, it's relevant and it's still very relevant. And I want to be clear, you know, Wicklander Jalowski is the best, it's the best training that anybody in the loss prevention and asset protection world can utilize to help them do their job. But at the end of the day, people kind of put their own tangents or their own style into the Wicklander Jalowski method. And I think that's where the danger exists sometimes, that we're talking about some of these things of suggestives or threats or all these other things that they're occurring. And again, I'm going to call it as I see it. Back in the day, early on, I remember as I was just kind of becoming comfortable with the interview technique and being comfortable with the interrogation process, I watched people that, you know, they did everything that you're not supposed to do. And this is how they approached it. And it was a numbers game and it was a pride game. And at the end of the day, it's all changing. It's all changing. And I think it's all changing for the best.
Yeah. And I think what, you know, in class, I always use this analogy is I pretend to be a golfer. I'm awful at it, but I'll go to the driving range and I'll hit 75 balls and I don't have anybody coaching me. So I probably am practicing the wrong way. But if half of those balls go, you know, 200 yards, I feel like I must be doing something right. And I keep doing it over and over again. And it's a bit of confirmation bias. And what happens is people go to our training or they go to any training and they learn a concept, you know, or a method like rationalizing, right? Which is, it's not going away, but it has to be done in a specific way. But then they go back out in the field and they say something a little bit off or they say something based on somebody else's feedback and it works. And then over time, they continue to change that and they realize it continues to work. And it goes back to the comment I made earlier that, you know, the ends don't justify the means. And something as simple as saying to your subject in the interview that, hey, I hope you and I can resolve this in the room today, that could give the perception there's no consequences. And something that I guarantee a lot of people listening have probably said, I've said it before, and realizing what's the perception of that statement and what could that do down the road for that conversation. So it's sticking to, you know, the core concepts, and it's ensuring that you're also getting consistent feedback from supervisors within the organization.
So in talking about why this happens, right? Like why, if the person that the LP professional is interviewing isn't going down the road of confessing, right? I always like to think about what are the pressures that make that so important to the LP professional. And now there's a couple things, one in my research that I found, and two, just anecdotally what people say. So one is when organizations put that quota on the loss prevention team to say, we need this many internals a month. I think that's nuts. I mean, granted, I haven't walked in you guys' shoes of being there and interviewing someone for a confession, but I think having a quota on me is going to make me push a little harder to get a confession. And then the other thing is, I don't want to wreck my 100% confession rate,
right. Yeah.
which I don't know because I haven't done it, but I have to say that sounds whack to me that you have never in your life interviewed somebody that may not have done it. And if you have either one of those pressures, are you truly walking in with something you said earlier, which is an open mind in the fact that this young kid, this executive, this CEO, this whoever you're interviewing may actually be innocent. Yes, you have evidence, you've got video, you've got all these things, but do they really have an open mind with those pressures? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the 100% confession rate is always something interesting to hear somebody pipe up in a seminar and boast about and get shut down immediately. I mean, really, if you're gonna claim to have a rate that's perfect then tells me either you've done maybe one interview or you're not open to other alternatives, or maybe any interview you do, you have black and white direct evidence without a doubt. There's no way around it. I mean, I know personally in all the interviews I've done, I have several I could count where maybe I interviewed somebody who was guilty but didn't confess. So I just obtained as much information as possible. And to me, that would be a success. Or I have somebody that I may have thought was guilty based off the evidence that I had, and then in the interview determined that the evidence was wrong, or there is a reasonable explanation for that evidence. I mean, I think one of the steps going forward is the enhancement of technology is an incredible advantage to investigators, no matter private sector or public sector, because I mean, when I first started doing interviews, the cameras we were using were not great, I guess is the easiest way to put that. And having things like RFID tracking and facial recognition and, you know, easier to retrieve remotely video surveillance and being able to do a thorough investigation before you go accuse somebody, I think is a huge step forward. Really what I think the message should be and is, especially in our seminars, is your goal for every one of those conversations should be the truth, regardless of what that may end up being. And if you're going to have a quota on everything, to me, it would be the amount of investigations that you're doing, not necessarily the results of that investigation. I mean, ultimately, you need to measure the success of your team. But if I interview somebody and determine that they weren't involved and I get more information, to me, that's a successful conversation. So I think that's one step forward. And in the public sector, I think we're at 25 states, and it might be growing, that are starting to mandate recording of interrogations. And having video of an interview or an interrogation also strengthens the power of information. So we don't necessarily need the I did it, but if we can get a subject to lock into a story we could prove or disprove, you know, that could be even more powerful or supplemental to the investigation. So really, to answer your question, Amber, I think the focus should be the truth and reliable information, and the confession might just be a side effect of that.
Well, I'll go back to one of your quotes that said, the most important piece of evidence will always be the truth. And I think if people can live by that and they can actually structure their approach to interviewing, then there should be no problem.
Yeah, and I think being open to that, there's a James Tranum is a former homicide detective, and he wrote a book, How the Police Generate False Confessions. And his book really inspired me in talking to him. Is he's somebody who was an investigator who you know has done several interviews and interrogations throughout his career, and he actually went back and critiqued one of his own interrogations and realized, you know, he gave up too much information to the suspect or the subject who confessed falsely, and he had to go and prove his own confession that he got was wrong and go out and find the right person. And that takes some courage to stand up and say, I think I did something wrong. Let me look back at my other cases and see what I could have done better. So, you know, being open to that critique and being open that whatever evidence you have in front of you may be wrong or may not be fully clear to the whole picture.
Well, false confessions is definitely a huge topic ever since the Dassey case. I know you've done a lot of work on that. So I know we've talked in the past where you said the most, the question you get all the time is the Making a Murderer series. So is that still the case, or has something else taken its place when you guys are answering questions in seminars?
Yeah, that still comes up a lot. And I think the documentary did a great job of highlighting not only, you know, Brendan's case, but the problem of false confessions everywhere. But I think what sometimes people forget is it's not just a TV show or documentary. It's real life and real people, and several victims have been affected. And I'll tell you, one of the number one questions I get is, you know, is Brendan innocent or guilty? And it's a great question that leads into an even better conversation. When you have a interview or an interrogation, private sector, public sector, wherever you're at, where an investigator contaminates the confession by giving up, you know, specific details of the crime and showing the evidence, and an investigator takes away consequences by saying honesty will set you free, and the subject changes their story multiple times or in the room for several hours without representation. When you have all those things together, it's impossible to identify what's true and what's false. And really that's what, you know, the courts are starting to recognize, is if you look at the totality of that interview, it's unreliable and in our opinion, involuntary. And so I think what's interesting about that is it's not the type of case where, you know, when you think false confession and really bad interrogation, you think, you know, crazy things like waterboarding and torture and physical abuse. And you don't see that in Brendan's case, which I think helps educate people even more. It's the subtlety of the words that are chosen and the environment that can really put somebody in a position where they do something or admit to something that, you know, maybe they didn't do.
Well, I can tell you that I think that the trust in law enforcement, the trust in loss prevention really has kind of diminished over the years. And I think some of that has to do with technology. I mean, we talked about one end of the technology for the investigation being extremely beneficial. But I also think that, you know, everybody is relying on their cell phone these days. Everybody is relying on recording everything and anything under the sun if it's confrontational. And I think that's something that we all have to be prepared for. Not only are we going to probably have to be recording ourselves more to protect ourselves as well as the subject, but I can also see people becoming more, I guess, more smart to defending themselves if necessary. And I can see a lot of people wanting to record their own interviews or conversations to make sure that they're protected.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously a caution everybody out there with recording is, you know, pay attention to your company and organizational policy and also, you know, what state you're in and a lot of consent rules out there depending on your state law. We've been recording since 1982. And, you know, recording is something that not only helps with some transparency, what happened in that room, but it's, you know, it's also a great tool to use as coaching and mentoring for the interviewer or even for yourself. Even at WZ, and you know, I consider to work with some of the most elite interviewers I've ever been, you know, encountering with, and we still go back and critique each other, and we'll watch an interview that we did, and we'll look through and see what could we have done better, what did we say that, you know, could have been perceived differently. And to the first comment you made, Kevin, talking about, you know, oftentimes now law enforcement or loss prevention are seen in a negative light, and you know, especially in the media nowadays, it's important to that people realize how difficult this part of the job is, where again, you're trying to get somebody to tell you something that I would consider a secret that they're probably not sharing with anybody else. And they know when they tell you that secret, there's going to be a consequence, whether it's, you know, termination or restitution, prosecution, embarrassment, shame, you know, loss of, you know, loved ones and the family and respect. And there's a lot of reasons not to tell the truth. And it's such a difficult job. And for the investigators that we've talked to on both sides of private or public sector, a lot of people embrace recording, whether it's, you know, body cameras or in the interrogation room, because they want people to know how they're getting the truth. And they want people to know that, you know, I gave Miranda rights in the public sector, or I allowed the subject to leave. It was a casual, friendly conversation.
Yeah, that's so true. I think what's really neat about you guys and WZ as a whole is that you put your time and your efforts where your passions are. And I know you're very involved as a big sponsor of the International Association of Interviewers, IAI, and you guys have your Elite Training Day event coming up April 11th and 12th, 2018. So one of your keynote speakers is actually a false confession expert, right?
Yeah, I'm excited for this. And I mean, we could talk about that. And even the last few years, Elite Training Day, we've brought in folks with other alternatives or other approaches on ways to, you know, prevent false confessions or just other alternatives to obtain more reliable information. So bringing in folks from the Innocence Project and academia is really important to us. And this coming year, I'm really excited to have Saul Kassman out of John Jay University come and speak with us. And I got a chance to meet with Saul a few weeks ago, and also had a chance a couple weeks ago to meet with a lot of his students out of the lab at John Jay, who just do tremendous work to try to enhance and educate what is going on in the world of interview and interrogation. And what I really enjoy about Saul and his group is they understand that you can't just keep telling people, don't do it this way, don't do it this way. There needs to be a way in order for investigators to get to the truth, but also a way to do it, you know, ethically, morally, and to minimize or prevent innocent people from confessing to these crimes. So I'm really looking forward to it. The conversations, anytime I talk to Saul, I feel, you know, more educated afterwards and inspired. So I'm excited for him to share that with the group.
Excellent.
Yeah. We echo each other.
That's right. No, this has been excellent. It really has. I mean, it's only our second podcast, but you know, the subject matter and the information and really just your expertise, it's really awesome. And this is where we want to go with this podcast. We want talklp.com to be an informational source. And we want our listeners to really be able to kind of take this information and take this conversation and use it to their benefit. So everything that we've talked about here today and everything that you've presented, it really is useful information and really good education.
I think that's great. Never stop learning. And that's, I will tell you from in my experience in this last year has been pretty humbling for me. I've had the opportunity to go to several different law schools and some college campuses that I probably should have never stepped foot on, and had the opportunity to just learn from some really bright, inspiring people. And that's helped reflect some change with what we're doing. So to everybody that's listening, I think what you guys are doing is great. Is, you know, never stop learning and always be open to, you know, is there a better way than something I've been doing in the past? You know, don't fear change. And I think we're all headed in the right direction.
Man, one of my favorite topics. Well, thanks so much, Dave Thompson, for joining us today on TalkLP.com.
Thanks to both of you guys for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to TalkLP.com.
Please visit our website at TalkLP.com to submit any topics you may be interested in hearing more about.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.